This is the fourth day of this July 2008 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from our text, which is the collected works of Chinu. And this is translated by Robert Buswell, Jr. Chinu was the 12th century Korean Zen master, considered one of the real patriarchs of the Korean Zen tradition. We'll pick up where we left off yesterday, where he was warning us about wasting time, and when this human birth is so rare, and we have now the possibility of awakening to our true nature, and what a terrible pity it would be to fritter away this great opportunity. And he continues along that line. Whenever we become discouraged or indolent, lazy, we should always look to the future. In one instant, we might happen to lose our lives and fall back into the evil bourns where we would have to undergo unspeakable suffering and pain. The evil bourns would be one of the three lowest of the six unenlightened realms of existence. So, the hell realm, the hungry ghost, thirsty spirit realm, or the animal realm. At that time, although we might want to hear one phrase of the Buddha Dharma and would be willing to receive and keep it with faithful devotion to ease our misfortune, how would we ever encounter it there? On the point of death, remorse is of no use whatsoever. I hope that all of you who are cultivating the path will not be heedless and will not indulge in greed and lust. Do not forget to reflect upon this as if you were trying to save your head from burning. This is an old analogy in Zen that we should practice with the same kind of fervor and urgency of one who is trying to put out fire in his own hair. Death is fast closing in. The body is like the morning dew. Life is like the twilight in the west. Although we are alive today, there is no assurance about tomorrow. Bear this in mind. You must bear this in mind. I suppose someone could hear these admonitions and sort of dismiss them as kind of well-meaning fire and brimstone talk of a preacher or something, like a Western preacher. But how do we know what our future will be? How do we know when, after this life, we might ever again encounter this Dharma? Our tendency as human beings, of course, is to not consider such things, just to take for granted that we've got plenty of time left and things will sort of take care of themselves. Do we want to bet on that? I hear these warnings as really as a plea, a sincere plea on the part of Chinuo, who, out of his profound compassion, is begging us to not lose this opportunity for our sake. I think he is utterly sincere and concerned for the welfare of those who might be heedless and waste time. We can imagine a similar situation where you're trying to reason with someone. You see some imminent catastrophe. Say someone is in the path of a tornado or something, and they're utterly unaware of it, and you're pleading with them to go, act now, don't wait, because you know that it could be terrible, terrible suffering. How many of the people in that situation might just go about their business and ignore your plea, no matter how earnest it is, how desperately you are trying to help them. I feel that's what he's really doing here. He goes on, I hope that all of you who are cultivating the path will study these words carefully and keep them always in mind. If this body is not ferried across to the other shore in this lifetime, then for which life are you going to wait? If you do not practice now, you will go off in the wrong direction for 10,000 kalpas. But if you practice assiduously now, practices which are difficult to practice will gradually become easier until, finally, meritorious practice will advance of itself. Practices which are difficult to cultivate will gradually become easier. This is the trajectory of Zen practice and in particular, Sesshin practice. Can be so difficult in the beginning and even on beyond the beginning, but if we just persevere, we find the secret to working with these adversities that arise. The secret, of course, is to simply become one with the practice. That is what guides us through all the briars and thorns of this Sesshin experience. And then finally, I hope that those of you who are aspiring to the path will not be cowardly. You must display your ardor. Good causes made in the past cannot be known. If you do not believe in your superiority and complacently resigning yourself to being inferior, you decide that you will not practice now because it is too difficult. Then even though you might have good roots from past lives, you sever them now. This superiority, inferiority thing is one of these terms that is quite common in Chinese Zen texts and Korean, I suppose, about the people of superior capacity, the people of inferior capacity. So he's not saying superior to other people, but your readiness, let's put it that way, your readiness or your affinity with the Dharma, your readiness, he says he's urging us to believe in our readiness and not complacently resign ourselves to being inferior. I think this sense of being inferior is much more troublesome for Western practitioners than any sense of being special in a superior way. The difficulty will keep growing and you will move farther from the goal. Since you have now arrived at the treasure house, how can you return empty-handed? Once you lose a human body, for 10,000 kalpas it will be difficult to recover. Be careful. Knowing that there is a treasure house, how can a wise person turn back and not look for it, and yet continue to resent bitterly his destitution and poverty? If you want the treasure, you must throw away this body. Be willing, in other words, willing to surrender ourselves utterly to this practice. Let go of our incessant involvement in our thoughts and fantasies. Come back to this reality, not this world, this abstract world in our head. This next chapter is called Straight Talk on the True Mind. Presumably he didn't have a straight talk express that he went around in. The introduction by the translator says that this straight talk on the true mind is probably Chinul's most accessible exposition of the Zen meditation techniques practiced in his era. And he said that this text suffered the same fate as Secrets on Cultivating the Mind, which we just read. It was lost in Korea during the Mongol invasions, and then in the 15th century it was reintroduced via the Northern Ming edition of the Tripitaka. I'll be skipping around here. There's just so much material. Much of it is not really quite suitable for reading aloud. Chinul said, in the Avatamsaka Sutra, it is stated, faith is the fountainhead of the path and the mother of all meritorious qualities. It nourishes all good roots. Good roots, of course, means our karma from previous times. And then he goes on, moreover, the consciousness-only texts say, faith is like a water-purifying gem which can purify cloudy water. It is clear that faith takes the lead in the development of the myriad of wholesome qualities. For this reason, the Buddhist sutras always begin with, thus have I heard, an expression intended to arouse faith. It's quite obvious why faith would be so terribly important. If we don't have some faith that our practice is going to work for us, is going to be of value, why would we do it? So at the very least, we have to have faith in the sitting, in the practice. And then beyond that, so much the better if we have faith that originally we are and have always been enlightened in our nature and can awaken to that. Question, what difference is there between faith in the patriarchal Zen and scholastic sects? So Zen as compared to the Sutra school or the scholastic. Chino, there are many differences. The scholastic sects encourage people and gods to have faith in the law of karmic cause and effect. Those who desire the pleasures which come from merit must have faith that the 10 wholesome actions are the sublime cause and that human or deva rebirth is the pleasurable result. So if we do good deeds, if we uphold the precepts, then we can reach the highest, the two highest of the six realms of unenlightened existence. Those who feel drawn to the void calmness of nirvana must have faith that its primary cause is the understanding of the cause and conditions of arising and ceasing, and that its fruition is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Those who would delight in the fruition of Buddhahood should have faith that the practice of the six paramitas over three asamkhya kalpas, say three eons, is its major cause, and bodhi and nirvana are its right fruition. So this, just to sum up, this is all about how we can advance in our practice, how we can evolve in our karma, by upholding the precepts, by reaching an understanding of the Four Noble Truths, and by polishing the practice of the six paramitas, the six perfections, endlessly. But then, as far as Zen, right faith in Zen is different. It does not believe in conditioned causes or effects. Or rather, it stresses faith that everyone is originally a Buddha, and that everyone possesses the impeccable self-nature, and that the sublime essence of nirvana is already complete in everyone. There is no need to search elsewhere. Since time immemorial, it has been innate in everyone. So, Zen does not reject cause and effect. That's why he sort of corrected himself there. It doesn't reject it, but it says there's this other aspect where there is nowhere to evolve to or from. There's nowhere to ascend. There's no ladder where we just plod our way through our pious religious practices and then become more and more pure and we find a better rebirth. From this perspective, what we could call the essential perspective, there is nowhere to advance, nowhere to go. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. This very body, the body of Buddha. In the Mumon Khan, in the last koan in the Mumon Khan, Mumon says in his verse, although each move is ahead of the next, know that there is another way up. Hence, we know that sentient beings are originally Buddhas. And then he says, once we have given rise to right faith, that is faith in our innate perfection and enlightened nature, we must add understanding to it. In other words, we need to confirm that innate enlightenment through the direct experience of it, awakening to it. As Jung Ming said, to have faith but no understanding increases ignorance. To have understanding but no faith increases wrong views. And then Chinul says, consequently, we know that once faith and understanding are merged, entrance onto the path will be swift. You could, when they're merged, this reminds me, Roshi Kaplan used to emphasize that in Zen, faith really means experience. That through our experience in actual practice, we develop faith. It's different from belief. Belief is where you just have to sell yourself on something and not have any real experiential basis for believing it. You just have to take it as something until you experience it. But faith in Zen is experience. You don't, in fact, you don't need to have faith in anything except what you confirm through your practice. Question, what is the essence of true mind like? Chinul, it states in the Radiating Light Prajna Sutra, Prajna is entirely free of signs. It has no signs of arising or ceasing. And then Chinul says, in the awakening of faith, it is said, the essence of true suchness itself neither increases nor decreases in any ordinary person, or Shravaka, Pratika Buddha, Bodhisattva, or Buddha. These are different stages of enlightenment. It did not arise in an earlier age and will not be annihilated in a later age. Ultimately, it is constant and eternal. Since the beginning, its nature has been utterly complete. And then he goes on, according to this sutra and shastra, the original essence of the true mind transcends cause and effect. It connects past and present. It does not distinguish between ordinary and holy. It is free from all relativity. It pervades all places like the vastness of space. Its sublime essence is settled and calm. It transcends all conceptual proliferation. It neither arises nor ceases. It neither exists nor does not exist. It is unmoving and unshakable. It is still and constantly abiding. It is uniformly calm and still. It is free of the slightest flaw or obscuration. All the mountains and rivers of the great earth, the grasses, trees, and forest groves, and all phenomena in creation appear from within it. If we have faith in this, we should realize that all the bodhisattvas of the three time periods are studying the same thing, this mind. All the Buddhas of the three time periods have the same realization, the realization of this mind. The teachings elucidated in the Tripitaka all elucidate this mind. The delusion of all sentient beings is delusion in regard to the mind. The awakening of all cultivators, all practitioners, is the awakening to this mind. The transmission of all the patriarchs is the transmission of this mind. The search in which all the patchwork monks of this world are engaged is the search for this mind. If we penetrate to this mind, everything is just the way it should be, and every material object is fully illuminated. But if we are deluded in regard to this mind, every place is inverted and all thoughts are mad. This essence is not only the Buddha nature with which all sentient beings are innately endowed, but also the basic source of creation of all worlds. When the world-honored one was momentarily silent at Vulture Peak, that is when he held up the flower, when Subhuti forgot all worlds below the cliff, when Bodhidharma sat in a small cell in wall contemplation, when Vimalakirti kept silent in Vaisali, all displayed the mind's sublime essence. Therefore, when we first enter the courtyard of the patriarch sect, we must understand the essence of this mind. The essence of this mind is completely revealed right here. You don't have to look back to Bodhidharma sitting in a small cell in the cave, Buddha holding up a flower, Vimalakirti's silence. Question. We have now learned about the sublime essence of the true mind, but what is meant by its sublime functioning? Chinu, the ancients said, the wind moves, but the mind shakes the tree. Clouds build up, but self-nature raises the dust. I'm reminded of the famous exchange where the sixth patriarch, Wei Nung, encountered a debate in the monastery between two monks who were arguing about the flapping of the temple flag. One monk said, it's the wind that moves. The other one argued that, no, it's the flag that moves. And they were going back and forth and getting nowhere until Wei Nung stepped forward and said, it is not the wind that moves, it is not the flag that moves, it is your mind that moves. At all times and in all activities, whether traveling eastward or westward, whether eating rice or donning clothes, whether lifting a spoon or handling chopsticks, whether looking left or glancing right, these are all manifestations of the sublime function of true mind. lifting the divider. Carrying it to the wall. Even standing ready to step forward to pick up one end of the divider, all the functioning of this mind. Walking along, finding a scrap of tissue on the floor that someone dropped by mistake, picking it up, functioning of this mind. Sitting on the toilet, functioning of this mind. Running to Doksan. Coughing. We can't get away from it. He goes on, ordinary people are deluded. When putting on clothes, they only understand that they are putting on clothes. When eating, they only understand that they are eating. In all their activities, they are deceived by appearances. Hence, they use the sublime function of the mind every day, but do not realize it. It is right before their eyes, but they are not aware of it. On the other hand, one who is conscious of true nature has no further misunderstandings in any of his actions. And then he quotes again, quotes a patriarch. Most of these allusions are not attributed to anyone in particular. In the womb, it is called a fetus. On being born, it is called a human. In the eye, it is vision. In the ears, it is hearing. In the nose, it is smelling. In the mouth, it is talking. In the hands, it is grasping. In the feet, it is running. When expanded, it contains all of the Dharma Dhatu. When contracted, it exists within one minute particle of dust. Those who are aware of it know that it is the Buddha nature. Those who are not call it soul or spirit. Master Dao Wu's dancing with his tablet, Master Shi Kung's aiming a bow, Master Mi Mo holding a pair of tweezers, Master Chu Ti's raising a finger, Master Shen Chao striking the ground, Master Yunyan's toy lion, all were displaying the great functioning of the mind. Okay, let's see what these things are. The first guy, whenever he was asked about the Dharma, he would simply take up his tablet and dance. The second guy had originally been a hunter. After his enlightenment, whenever someone asked him about the Dharma, he would draw his bow and aim straight at the questioner. The third guy, says his holding a pair of tweezers has caused problems in translation. And then he goes off into different translators. One guy gave it the translation of a nutcracker, and another one called it a pitchfork. So, okay, we'll leave that one. And then the next guy, this is Gute, as we know him in the Japanese name in the Mumonkan. Whenever he was asked a question, he merely held up one finger in reply. And then Yunyan, whenever whenever students, this is not Yunmen, famous Yunmen, this is another one. Whenever students came to ask Yunyan about the Dharma, he would tease them with a toy lion carved out of wood. It's got, there's a Sangha entertainment skit in there. Oh, you want to know what the Dharma is? Oh, look here. Yeah. Ask this guy. Talk to the hand. Talk to my little lion here. Oh, what's your name? I'm going on skipping through stuff. It's just too ponderous here to read aloud. Question: if everyone is endowed with the essence and function of true mind, how is it that sages and ordinary people are not the same? Chinul: the true mind is originally the same in the sage and the ordinary person. But because the ordinary person endorses the reality of material things with a false mind, he loses his pure nature and becomes estranged from it. Therefore, the true mind cannot appear. It is like a tree's shadow in darkness or a spring flowing underground. It exists, but it is not perceived. In Sung Chao's treatises, it is written, "Between heaven and earth and within the universe is contained a jewel. It is concealed in the mountain of form." And then Chinul says, this refers to the true mind amid entanglements. Furthermore, Zuan said, "Ordinary people originally possess the Dharmakaya, which is identical with that of all the Buddhas. But as they are screened from it by falsity, they have it but do not recognize it. This innate Dharmakaya, which is present within the entanglements of defilement, have been given the name Tathagatagarbha." It really means Buddha nature. Pei Shu said, "Ordinary people," which is the way that it's in texts where translators refer to the unenlightened, so-called unenlightened. "Ordinary people are those who are fully enlightened the whole day long without ever knowing it." Therefore, we know that even amid the troubles of the dusty world, the true mind remains unaffected by those troubles. Like a piece of white jade which has been thrown in the mud, its color remains unchanged. Through deep enough absorption in practice, we can confirm what he says here, that whatever difficulties we're experiencing in Sesshin, we can reach this realm of no thought where true mind remains unaffected by these difficulties. It is an absolutely joyous experience. The first time this happens is to, in the midst of the pain and the crashing of thoughts and confusion and everything, to just bore right through that into the practice and reach this space where all of that noise and trouble recedes, and it's like something in the distance doesn't affect one. Everyone can experience this. question. If people have no mind, they are the same as grass or trees. Please help us understand this idea of no mind. Chinu, when I said no mind, I did not mean that there is no mind essence. It is only when there are no things in the mind that we use the term no mind. It is like speaking of an empty bottle. We mean that there is no thing in the bottle, not that there is no bottle. We do not say that it is empty to express the idea that it is made of no material. A patriarch said, and this one I tracked down, it's Dershan or Toksan, if you have no concerns in your mind and no mind in your concerns, then naturally your mind will be empty yet numinous, calm yet sublime. It is mind in this sense that is meant here. Accordingly, we refer to the absence of the deluded mind, not to the absence of the true mind sublime functioning. Question. We have heard that those who have seen true mind transcend birth and death. However, all the patriarchs of the past had seen this true nature, and yet they all were born and they all died. Nowadays, we see that those who are cultivating the path are born and will die too. How can we leave behind birth and death? Well, this is just a elementary question from someone who's taking it literally. But let's go with this. Chinu, birth and death are originally non-existent. They exist because of a false notion. It is like a person with diseased eyes who sees flowers in the sky. If a person without this disease says there are no flowers in the sky, the afflicted person will not believe it. But if his disease is cured, the flowers in the sky will vanish naturally, and he can then accept that they were non-existent. Although the flowers he sees have not yet vanished, they are, in fact, still void, empty. It is only the sick person who takes them to be flowers. Their essence does not really exist. In the same way, people wrongly assume that birth and death exist. If a person free of birth and death tells them that birth and death are originally non-existent, they will not believe him. But one morning, if delusion is put to rest and birth and death are spontaneously abandoned, they will realize that birth and death are originally non-existent. We can be sure that if we have a penetrating awakening to the true mind of complete enlightenment, then, as originally, there is no birth or death. Yeah, the next paragraph is quite long, so we'll stop here now and recite the four vows.